From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, Bruce Lee, the actor and martial arts master who launched the Kung Fu revolution in this country. He was a teacher raised in Hong Kong who developed his own technique and philosophy for fighting and for life. And Lee was just about to break out on his way to becoming a phenomenon, and then at 32, he died. Matthew Pauly has written a biography of Bruce Lee. He'll join us after this.
Maybe you've heard we're a divided country, but here at KUER, we're going to challenge that idea. I'm Andrea Smartin, the host of Next Door Strangers, a new podcast about finding connection in a time of division. For this to work, we need your help. We'll be asking you to try some things that might take you out of your comfort zone, but maybe that's what we need right now. Next Door Strangers, a new podcast from KUER. Subscribe at KUER.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Matthew Pauly says Bruce Lee is arguably the most famous face on the planet. But when he died in July of 1973, suddenly, at the age of 32, not that many people in the U.S. would have recognized him on the street. He was about to blow up as a major celebrity in the U.S., but he hadn't yet. I mean, he was huge throughout Asia. His action films made in Hong Kong, where he was raised, films like Fist of Fury and The Big Boss, they were wildly popular there, but in the West, not yet. Lee was 5'7", 135 pounds, soaking wet, but he was intense and focused and chiseled, and everyone had huge expectations for his next film, Enter the Dragon, which was set to open in August. Those who had seen advanced screenings said the film was amazing. Lee was scheduled to be on The Tonight Show for the first time, but then he died under suspicious circumstances. Really, before his time. Today in the program, Matthew Pauly is joining us to talk about his new biography of Bruce Lee. Pauly is a fellow at Yale University. His writing has appeared in The Washington Post and Esquire and Slate. He's the author of a number of books about martial arts, and his new book is called Bruce Lee, A Life. The film, Enter the Dragon, was a hit, like people had predicted it would be, and Bruce Lee, Pauly says, inspired millions of people to take up martial arts, including himself.
Yeah, when I first encountered Bruce Lee, I was a skinny, bullied 12-year-old, picked on the playgrounds, and secretly wanted to be tough, wanted to be a superhero, and I didn't know who Bruce Lee was. I'd never seen a kung fu movie, but when I saw him on screen blasting his way through dozens of bad guys, I wanted to be Bruce Lee. You know, one of my jokes is that kung fu is China's way of tricking 13-year-old boys into meditating. They all think that they're going to be tough guys. That's what you want when you're 13, because you feel powerless. The world, everyone's bigger than you. As you get older, you realize that physical strength has its limits, and not every situation can be resolved by that, and that there's an inner struggle that everyone has to go through. And so when I got to college, I ended up studying, like Bruce, he was a philosophy major. I was actually a religion major. Hmm. And so I read many of the same books that he did, Alan Watts about Zen Buddhism, and a lot of the Western philosophers and also Eastern mystics. And that's also what attracted me to Kung Fu, is that it combined both. You can go to a boxing gym and box, but there's not a philosophy behind it. And yeah, one of the great attractions about the Eastern martial arts is there is an aspect of a spiritual path as well.
In one of the eulogies during Bruce Lee's funeral here in the United States in Seattle, a friend, Ted Ashley, said that in 35 years of movie making, he had never seen someone who, and I'll quote the quote that you include in the book, who wanted more and tried harder for perfection than Bruce Lee. Let's talk a little bit about that. How do you understand that, as someone who went through what you went through, the looking for a spiritual practice to connect to a physical practice? Does this idea of the search for perfection make more sense to you in that way?
It does. I think what was interesting about Bruce Lee is that he, from a very young age, was hyper-competitive, and he always wanted to be the best. And whenever he, like, he had various interests, one of them was dancing. He was the cha-cha champion of Hong Kong.
Right.
And he would brag about that. That was one of his favorite things to talk about. He wanted to be a leading actor. And in martial arts, he wanted to be the best fighter. In fact, that's what got him into the martial arts. And I think that competitive drive can also be pointed towards a spiritual direction. This idea of gaining more and more wisdom, achieving greater enlightenment. And I think there was an ambition that drove every aspect of his life, including his spiritual life.
One of the things that you explore is these perceptions. They're the Chinese self-perception, but also I think the perception, and these are decades, hundreds of years old, it seems like, these stereotypes that we have of the Chinese, how it fits in Western culture. Because it seems like the reason there aren't, and this may be a conclusion you've come to, the reason there aren't or weren't that many biographies, as you've said, there were a lot about Steve McQueen, weren't very many about, really good ones anyway, about Bruce Lee, and you think it's a kind of bigotry there. So I wanted to talk a little bit about these perceptions, because you talk about the stereotype of the Chinese man, submissive, non-aggressive, physically inferior, even sexually inferior. And Bruce Lee really smashed that image, but I wanted you to talk about that because this idea of bigotry, these stereotypes, seem an important bit of context in this story.
Yeah, it dates back to the 1850s when Chinese Americans were first brought over to America to work the mines. And the reason they were brought over is because slavery had been abolished almost everywhere in the world, and the capitalists were looking for cheap labor. Yeah. And so they brought over Chinese peasants. It was called the coolie trade. And they worked the mines. And then when the gold dried up, they worked building the Pacific Railroad. And at the time, because they were under harsh contracts, they weren't citizens. They could be kicked out at any time. The way they survived was to keep their head down and stay out of the way and not draw any attention to themselves. And this built a stereotype of the Chinese man as somehow submissive and passive and unwilling to fight back. And in 1882, there was the Chinese Exclusion Act, in which all Chinese were banned, which pulls into today's immigration debates. And so the way Chinese in America survived was to huddle into their Chinatowns and to try to stay out of the way. And I think that ties into why there were no biographies of Bruce Lee, because Asians in America are often overlooked and they're not considered part of the culture. And so why would you write a biography about the most famous Asian American to ever live? Asian Americans aren't important to the story of America. And that's what I think Bruce Lee was trying to break down, not only the stereotype of the submissive Chinese male, but just the idea that they could be ignored, that they wouldn't be heroes. And we're slowly starting to see that change with movies like Crazy Rich Asians.
Yeah.
Asians telling their story and becoming part of the mosaic of the stories of America.
I wanted to ask you, when you first figured, okay, I'm going to do this, I'm going to write this book about Bruce Lee, where did you think you could start or should be able to start? I mean, what's so fascinating to me is you had to go to Hong Kong. You had to, you know, you had to hire a translator, someone to take you around. I mean, there weren't a lot of sources you could go with. I mean, you had to just do a lot of this work on the ground, it seems.
Yeah, a lot of this was about reporting, and I felt the most important aspect was to get his life in Hong Kong. Bruce Lee was born in America. He was born in San Francisco, so he was an American citizen, but his parents were from Hong Kong, and they returned with him as a baby. So from 3 months to 18 years of age, he lived in Hong Kong. He only lived 32 years, so over half of his life was in Hong Kong, and yet most of the stories written about Bruce Lee are written about his time after he gets to America, because, of course, it's easier to find English language sources who will talk to you if you're a reporter who only speaks English. I speak Mandarin, which is the northern dialect. I don't speak Cantonese, which is the Hong Kong dialect. Yeah. So I did. I went and I got a translator, and I spent 6 months in Hong Kong just going around trying to find anybody who knew Bruce Lee and was willing to talk.
Explain what's going on socially and politically at the time. That context, I think, is really interesting for his early life and the life of his father, too. I mean, you've got this first constitutional republic has replaced the ancient Chinese dynasty. You have Great Britain then, of course, as sort of colonial masters in Hong Kong. You've got this struggle between nationalists and communists. I mean, there's a lot of kind of tension and conflict that's important to understand.
That's right. The Chinese patriots call it the century of humiliation. Yeah. And what happened was Western colonialists arrived in China with superior military technology. They had guns, and the Chinese were still using swords and spears. And so they ended up conquering parts of China, including Hong Kong, which was taken as a colony by the British. And so the Chinese were subjects there. They were second-class citizens. The colony was run by British masters, and they were very resentful of this fact. And then it gets worse for China. As you mentioned, the Qing Dynasty falls in 1912. They try to form the First Republic. It collapses into civil war between Chiang Kai-shek, the nationalist, and Chairman Mao. And so there's decades of civil war between the two. And Hong Kong then becomes a kind of refugee colony. Bruce Lee's father actually lived in southern China and fled to Hong Kong to find better work. And Hong Kong has millions and millions of refugees, and it's a kind of teeming mass. And so there's corruption, there's crime, there's triads and gangs, there's corrupt cops. It's not the pretty shopping mall that we think of when we think of Hong Kong today. It was really a third world refugee camp that Bruce Lee was growing up in. And so that sense of physical danger was ever present on the streets for kids who were going back and forth. And that's part of the reason martial arts was attractive.
Yeah. You say in the book that that Bruce Lee really launched the kung fu and martial arts revolution in Western culture. What was it like before? Just mention that we'll dig into this in a moment here, but before all of that, what was the sense of martial arts culture in the United States before Bruce Lee, I suppose?
Yeah, so martial arts was first brought over to America by Japanese teachers in the 19-teens. Japan was growing in confidence and it wanted to show the Western world some of its culture. So judo masters would go to places like Brazil and England and America and teach some of it. And so there were early students of judo as early as 1920. And then what really kind of progressed martial arts in America was the World War II. Afterwards, soldiers were stationed in Okinawa, and that's where they picked up karate. And then, of course, the Korean War, and afterwards you had soldiers stationed in South Korea, which is where they picked up Taekwondo and Tang Soo-do. And these white military servicemen, ex-servicemen, came back to the States and started opening up little dojos. But what America didn't have was any of China's martial arts. That existed only in the Chinatowns and wasn't taught to Westerners. And so Bruce Lee was the first one to really sort of break open Chinese martial arts to the West.
I think we have to put Bruce Lee's fame in perspective. When he died, as you mentioned in the book, in the United States, he was really just about to break, just emerging, really. In Asia, though, Bruce was, here's how you put it in the book, he was bigger than the Beatles. But in the United States, I mean, before Enter the Dragon, this classic film, was released, he was just kind of, you describe him as an obscure TV actor. His death really only warranted a few short newspaper obituaries here in the United States. There weren't that many people who showed up at his funeral in Seattle, even though it was, there were throngs of people who showed up at the funeral in Hong Kong. Just that's an interesting contrast. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, one of the things I found fascinating is that Bruce Lee is the only celebrity of the 20th century whose fame outside of Asia is entirely posthumous.
Yeah.
In Hong Kong, he had gone back and he had made three movies that were the biggest movies that Hong Kong had ever seen. And so in Hong Kong and Singapore and Taiwan, along anywhere there were Chinese migrants living, Bruce Lee was a superstar, bigger than the Beatles. But in the States, he'd only appeared for a year as Kato and the Green Hornet about 5 years earlier. And so most people had no idea who he was. And when he was buried in Seattle, a couple of UPI reporters showed up, maybe a couple fans. There were a few obituaries. They got a lot of things wrong in the obituaries, which is always a good sign that you're not very famous.
Yeah.
And a month later, Enter the Dragon opens, and then Bruce Lee becomes the biggest star in the world. But no one knew who he was, and so his mythology began immediately because there was no biographical celebrity history beforehand.
Yeah.
I mean, he was scheduled to be on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, and that would have changed everything for him.
Yeah. Let's back up and talk about his father. This is because it seems like in some way his father's story as a striver, a gifted with a kind of an attitude, seems to mirror the story of his son in some ways. His father was, as you put it, a famous Cantonese opera singer. Here's Bruce Lee's father when he's young, singing out the specials to a restaurant on the streets. And basically, he discovers him. Would you tell that story? This is really great.
Yeah, so his mother came from a very wealthy family, yeah, but his father came from dirt poor peasantry. His grandfather had such bad luck, they thought he was cursed. And so the boys, they didn't go to school. They had to work from a very young age. And one of the jobs that his father could get was hawking the menu for restaurants.
Yeah.
And at that time in southern China, they would hire young peasant boys to sing the menu items to try to entice customers to come in the way today, you know, someone will stand on the street and hand you a pamphlet. So instead they would sing. And his father turned out had a quite a good voice. And one day a famous opera singer was walking by and heard him sing and decided to make him his disciple. And that's how his father escaped a desperate poverty.
Yeah.
And started a career as an actor. He was discovered, like all the famous stories of Hollywood people being discovered.
Yeah. It's also extraordinary, as you kind of mentioned there, that he falls in love with a woman well above his station in class. And she falls back in love with him. Say something about his mother, Grace.
So his mother was Eurasian. And this is what's interesting about Bruce, is that he was not pure Chinese.
Yeah.
He was part European and part Chinese. And his mother came from an extraordinarily rich family. Her uncle was the richest man in Hong Kong, and her father was the second richest in Hong Kong. And so their clan had an incredible amount of power. And her father had hired Bruce Lee's father's opera troupe to come perform for the family. Hmm. And she saw him perform. He was a good-looking young man with a great sense of humor, and she fell for him and pursued him and defied her parents, who basically cut her off.
Yeah.
Because she married a poor actor.
I was really taken by that story, I have to say. I mean, you know, she wasn't necessarily disowned, but certainly cut off financially. And she agrees,
that's right,
to live this much more modest life. I mean, she was really in love. It's kind of a beautiful story.
It is, because we forget that at that time in China, all marriages were arranged, particularly amongst the elites, because they were about financial obligations. And so she was supposed to marry some scion of another family. And her marrying an actor was almost insulting to her family. And so she rebelled for love.
Say something about how Bruce Lee ends up being born in the United States. His mother and father, his father basically goes on tour to the U.S. That's how it happens.
Bruce Lee's father was a famous Cantonese opera singer. And at that time, the war had broken out in China between the Japanese and China. The Japanese had invaded. And so there was a desire to raise money from overseas Chinese. The overseas Chinese living in America were actually wealthier than the Chinese back home. And he was offered an opportunity to go on tour through America and perform and also raise money for the war effort. And their first stop was in San Francisco because San Francisco has the biggest Chinatown in the world. And that's where they stayed for most of the time. And his wife went with him to make sure he came home, as the family likes to joke. And she got pregnant while she was there. And Bruce Lee was born in San Francisco's Chinatown.
Yeah.
In fact, his name, Jun Fan Lee, means to shake up or excite San Francisco.
Right. You mentioned that when they finally come back to Hong Kong, the situation was turning from bad to worse. Circumstances get really ugly there. And it's interesting, his father, Bruce Lee's father, kind of gets lucky, it seems like. He does fairly well, even though the conditions there are pretty bad, and the Japanese are their treatment of the Chinese is pretty terrible. But his father gets by, and it's a pretty impressive part of the story, I have to say.
Yeah, so the Japanese continued their invasion of China, and then the same day that the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, we in America forget, they also attacked Hong Kong. And so they launched a war against Britain and America on the exact same day. And they very quickly ran over the British defenses because Britain was already engaged in a war against the Germans. And the Japanese rule was tyrannical. A third of the population was murdered or starved, a third fled, and a third survived by any means necessary. But the Japanese had one weakness, and that was for Chinese opera.
Yeah.
And that turned to be this family's salvation, which is that his father got a slightly bigger ration than everybody else in the colony. And so he was able to use that and parlay that into buying up rental properties. He bought up apartments. And then when the war ended, everybody flooded back into Hong Kong. And so the value of the apartments that he'd bought when everybody was either dead or had left suddenly skyrocketed. Yeah. And so not only was he a famous actor, but also a real estate mogul.
So this is the kind of the stew in which Bruce Lee is born, in this kind of all these hundreds of thousands of refugees streaming back into Hong Kong after it's liberated after the war. And I wanted to ask how it is you figure Bruce Lee ends up with this attitude that he has. I mean, you describe him as pugnacious and short-tempered. Also, and this is really interesting in the book, you know, he's pretty self-centered. He could be kind of violent. He had moments of being angry. I mean, where does he get this attitude as far as you can tell? Where does this come from?
I think a little bit was that he was born with it.
Yeah.
Another, you know, everybody might, I have a young son, and you realize they're born with their own soul.
Right.
They come with something that's unique to them that has nothing to do with how you parent. Another aspect was he nearly died of cholera when he was a few months old, when he came back to Hong Kong and during the occupation. And so I think there was something about a fighter's spirit to him that he was able to survive that disease, which left him unable to walk properly until he was 4 and shorter and frailer than the other boys. And so that put a chip on his shoulder. And I think you can really understand Bruce Lee is the kind of short, skinny kid with a chip on his shoulder who feels the need to prove himself in every situation.
Yeah. What kind of a fighter was he? Because really he is, and this is in some ways before he looks into martial arts. I mean, he was a street fighter. And you mention how he gets caught up in this growing movement of Chinese nationalism. They start picking fights with the British young people. Talk a little bit about that, because this seems really formative for Bruce Lee.
That's right. So Bruce, as Hong Kong was teeming with refugees, there were a lot of gangs on the street, and the young boys started to form their own. And I often thought of it as a bit like West Side Story.
Yeah.
The British sharks and the Chinese jets. The Chinese resented the British rule. And so one way they took out their resentment is they would go over to the school with all the British kids and wait for them to come outside and start taunting them until a fight would start. And Bruce Lee was a bit of a gang leader as a young kid. It was a middle-class gang leader. Yeah. It wasn't criminal. Yeah. But he would go out and he would pick these fights. And that's really what he was. And so everyone who talked about him, and I talked to a lot of his classmates, would tell me, you know, Bruce Lee was really great if you were one of you were a member of his gang, but if you weren't, you could be in trouble.
Yeah. Mention, if you would, Matthew, how he comes to be in the movies. This is based on, I guess, the connection from his father, and the fact that, as you point out, the mecca of Chinese filmmaking shifts from Shanghai during this time to Hong Kong.
That's right. So his father was a famous Cantonese opera actor, and very quickly after the war ends, Chinese filmmaking, which was in Shanghai, moves to Hong Kong because of the civil war continuing in China. And Bruce Lee's father, as a stage actor, starts getting opportunities to make movies. And he brings his children on set. And most of the other kids had no interest, but Bruce Lee loved it. He thought it was like a jungle gym. So he would climb around everywhere, and he had this incredible energy. One of his nicknames was Never Sit Still. And he today they would have put him on Ritalin.
Yeah.
he was hyperactive as a kid, and they noticed it. One of his directors of his father's movies noticed Bruce Lee's energy and decided to cast him in a part with his father, and that launched his childhood acting career. His first movie he made when he was 6, and he went on to make 20 by the time he was 18.
And his signature move shows up pretty early, you say, what you describe as this kind of stagger, this, you know, swagger, this kind of cocky bravado. That comes out pretty early.
That's right. He would play kind of street urchins. And he had this in the movie The Kid, which was made in 1950. He was 10 years old. He has a scene where he fights an adult. And in that scene, he rips his shirt open, thumbs his nose, and charges this adult male and beats him up in the fight. And when you look at it, you can actually see moves where you're like, oh, I've seen that in the adult movies.
Yeah.
So you can see the child is the father to the man.
Let's talk about his interest in martial arts. This was interesting to me. You say kung fu was not a popular hobby in Hong Kong when Bruce was growing up. And in fact, you say, you know, so-called good society actually shunned the martial arts at the time.
That's right. It was a bit like boxing in the 1950s, which was associated with the mob and with the lower classes. And so Bruce was actually a member of the upper class. His father had done quite well, and his mother came from a very elite family. And so while he was pugnacious and got into fighting, he didn't really think about martial arts as an avenue to continue this pursuit until after there was a famous challenge match that occurred in Hong Kong. And afterwards, it became kind of faddish to study kung fu in the colony. And you see that here in the States. Like at some point, yoga becomes the thing that everyone does, or everybody has to learn mixed martial arts today. So it's or jiu-jitsu. You see a lot of guys who are like, of course, I study Brazilian jiu-jitsu. And so there's these kind of fads that occur in all cultures. And I thought it was fascinating because we think of Hong Kong as like, oh, of course, everybody was studying kung fu. But that wasn't the case.
And you mentioned that there were dozens and, you know, dozens of different styles of kung fu. And you say in the book that you could walk from one village to the next and encounter a half a dozen different masters teaching radically different systems. And each system has it's this mythical origin story. Talk a little bit about that. And then the one that that Bruce Lee takes to, this is Wing Chun.
That's right. So Chinese martial arts, and in Japan, it was much more rigid and there was a much more defined system. Chinese, a thousand flowers blossomed. There's a different type of martial art almost everywhere you go. And I found it fascinating when I studied kung fu in China that I would go to the next village and they were like, ah, yeah, you do it that way, but here we do it this way. And even in Hong Kong, there were a dozen different styles that were followed by different people. Hungar, Southern Crane, And Wing Chun was a really obscure style that not many people studied. And it's and every style has its mythical origin story. And this style's origin, supposedly, was that it was created by a Shaolin nun. It's one of the few styles that's considered to be created by a woman. Yeah. And it was dedicated, its purpose was to work with a smaller, less muscular frame. It was designed for women, and since Bruce Lee was shorter and weaker than boys his age, it seemed to appeal to him.
It's Wing Chun is popularized by one man in particular. Ip Man is his name. Explain who he is, because his relationship with Bruce Lee is important to the story.
Yeah, so Ip Man was a police officer from a very well-to-do family in southern China. But when the revolution takes place and the communists start winning, he has to run away and he loses everything, all of his property. Yeah. And he had been an expert in Wing Chun Kung Fu. And the only way he can survive in Hong Kong is to try to teach it to younger students. And he had a very easy, calm confidence about him and an excellent sense of humor. Most of his students were like Bruce. They were young street toughs who wanted to get into fights. And he had a calming influence. He would give them all nicknames. And he taught them about Taoism and about the importance of being like water, which is something Bruce Lee, of course, is very famous for saying. Right. But he got that from his teacher, who was not only a martial arts master, but also a kind of spiritual guide.
Be calm like water, Ip Man told him.
That's right.
The physical part of Wing Chun was interesting, too. You say in the book that it emphasized close quarters combat, low kicks, quick short punches. The short punches part stood out for me because, of course, that's part of the idea, at least that people have of the kind of the art that that Bruce Lee developed, his own martial style.
That's right. So his own style of martial art, which he called Jeet Kune Do, he developed later in life when he felt limited by what he had learned from Ip Man. But many of the principles were drawn from what he had learned as a boy. I often joke, you never really escape the religion of your childhood. And I think it's true of Bruce. He learned certain principles, which was to be very economical, very direct, and get in close and knock an opponent's head off. And that's the way Bruce Lee approached fighting and his own style of martial arts.
He has this epiphany that he wrote about in 1961. He says that he began to understand the principles of gentleness, that is the art, as he put it, of neutralizing the effect of the opponent's effort and minimizing the expenditure of someone's energy. It's this. Ip Man described it as the art of detachment. And I wanted you to kind of explain this, because this seems like the essence of Bruce Lee's kind of take, the way he fought and the way he thought about this.
I've always felt that Bruce Lee was searching for an antidote to himself.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that is Bruce Lee was his nickname was the Little Dragon, and he was really a fire element. He had a fiery temper. He was quick to get angry, but he was also quick to forgive. And he was always popping off and getting into trouble. And so this idea of being like water, being relaxed, letting go, being detached, being emotionally distant from these things were at a real attraction to him, because it was the yin to his yang. He was all yang energy, all masculine, all tough guy. Yeah. And he was searching for a way to balance that out. And that's what he got from Ip Man.
How effective as a martial art strategy was the Jeet Kune Do that he invents, basically develops, starting, I think it was 1968. Talk a little bit about the development of that. And as you say, he felt limited by these other forms. Talk a little bit about how this particular form that he invents and evolves.
Yeah, so when he comes to the States, there's no one who knows Wing Chun, so there's no one for him to practice with. And immediately he begins picking up students. Everywhere Bruce Lee went, he picked up followers. He just was that kind of charismatic leader type of figure. And he's teaching them Wing Chun from his memory, but he's got no one to practice with. And what he realizes is that the Americans have their own sort of interesting martial arts, wrestling and boxing, and also some judo that they had learned from the Japanese. And so he begins incorporating things from his environment, things he picks up from his students. He also notices that his students, unlike his Chinese classmates, are taller and bigger. And so techniques that would work against someone who's 5'8" doesn't work against a 6'3" white guy who's 250 pounds. And so he realizes he needs to start adapting. And he ends up creating the style of Jeet Kune Do, which was a combination of boxing, kung fu, and interestingly, Western fencing. And he begins to think of his style as a kind of unarmed version of fencing.
Yeah. It's interesting what happens after he dies. That there was, you know, the effort to, it seems like, codify it in some ways. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about that, because that seems kind of contrary to the principle itself. There seemed to be kind of fluidity to the concept. And after he died, it seemed like there was this idea of trying to codify it more.
That's right. So Bruce Lee's... he was a bit of a child of the 60s. He was very much anti-establishment, and he was anti-classical kung fu. And what he complained about was this idea that you should rigidly follow tradition because it's tradition. And he had a certain sort of pragmatic sense of you should use what works and get rid of anything that doesn't. And he also felt that every martial artist should create their own style. They shouldn't just do something because that's what their teacher taught them. So Bruce Lee set out to create a style for himself. And as he was teaching it, he realized his students were just following him. And that was frustrating to him. And so he closed down several of his schools in America and tried to disband Jeet Kune Do. But of course, he dies and his students do exactly what he told them not to do. They codified the system and then got into arguments with each other.
Matthew Pauly. His book is Bruce Lee Alive. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
KUER's community of sustainers do so much for the station. Because of their ongoing contributions, we're able to bring you award-winning local news, NPR coverage, Radio West, and our own podcasts. Starting at $5 a month, you can be a sustainer too. Then, next time you hear a story you love, you'll know you made it happen. Become a sustainer at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Matthew Pauly. We're talking about his new biography, Bruce Lee, A Life. Explain what happens on May 10th of 1973. And maybe we should say where he's headed. Bruce Lee, before all of this, as we said at the beginning of the program, he is headed toward, I don't know, fame and greatness in the United States. He's really emerging. It becomes pretty clear he's going to make it.
That's right. What we don't realize is that within the movie industry, once a movie gets filmed, people start buzzing about it. People who see early shots of it, early cuts. And Enter the Dragon had finished filming but hadn't been released yet, and already the buzz had started. Warner Brothers knew it had a hit on its hands, and it was going to make Bruce Lee a star. In fact, they were planning to launch two more sequels to Enter the Dragon. And Bruce Lee was discussing scripts, and he was getting million-dollar offers. And so he realized he finally, after years and years of struggling against a racist system in Hollywood, he was going to be the first Chinese-American male actor to ever star in a Hollywood movie and become an international icon.
Yeah.
And so he's terrified that this will all be taken away from him, because previously in his career, he thought he was going to be a big deal when he starred in The Green Hornet. Yep. But when that was canceled, it all went away. So on May 10th, 1973, he goes into a small room, a dubbing room, in order to re-loop lines of dialogue for Enter the Dragon. it's the hottest day of the month. They turn off the air conditioning so it doesn't affect the sound. And within 20 minutes, he gets woozy and dizzy and collapses and is taken to the hospital and nearly dies of cerebral edema. Yeah. And this incident, I think, was an example of heat stroke, that he simply got overheated in this small sauna-like room.
But of course, what complicates that moment and the fact that he dies a few months later is that he had that he took hash. It was just sort of something that he did, and it comes to kind of complicate the story of how he dies and the arguments over how he had died.
That's right. So Bruce Lee, one of the things I think was difficult with people understanding him is they thought of him as a martial artist first, who kind of accidentally became an actor. But he really was an actor from very young who became a martial artist and then combined the two. And so when he was living in 1960s Hollywood, everybody was smoking pot.
Yep.
And his students, two of his martial arts students, were James Coburn and Steve McQueen, who were both fairly fluid drug users, if I can phrase it that way. And Steve McQueen introduced Bruce Lee to marijuana. Bruce didn't like to drink, but he realized that marijuana kind of calmed him down and chilled him out, which is something he always looked for because he was so hyper. And that became part of his sort of, I don't know how often he used it. He was a sort of casual pot smoker, or he would nibble on some hash. And right before he collapsed, he went to the bathroom to try to calm down because he wasn't feeling well. And he put some hash in and chewed on it and swallowed it and then collapsed again. And so the doctors, who didn't know anything about marijuana in Hong Kong in the 1970s, blamed the hash for his collapse. Yeah.
So ironic that in Hong Kong, which had opium at various times all over the place, marijuana was such a taboo.
That's right. And what you realize, of course, is that drugs become culturalized. Yeah. And so certain drugs are considered okay for people to use. Opium, his father was an opium addict. People smoked opium quite freely in Hong Kong. But marijuana, because it was associated with the hippies, was considered extraordinarily dangerous, which, of course, we know now is the exact opposite. Opioids, which we have a crisis with in this country, is horribly addictive. And marijuana is a fairly mild drug as far as they go.
You really work us through, as readers, the last day of Bruce Lee's life. Let's talk a little bit about what happens. This is July 20th of 1973.
Right. So on July 20th, 1973, Bruce Lee was prepared to be a superstar. Yeah. He wrote a letter to his lawyer stating that he wanted to start a clothing line. There was going to be a TV, animated TV series based on his life that Hanna-Barbera was going to produce. He was all ready for everything to happen. He went into work. He met with George Lazenby, who played James Bond in Her Majesty's Secret Service. He was the Australian James Bond who only played him once. And Lazenby wanted to be in Bruce Lee's next film because Bruce Lee was the biggest thing in Asia. And after that meeting, he decided to go visit his mistress, Betty Ting Pei, and spend some time with her before going back to work. And he ended up spending the entire afternoon there. And at the very end of the day, he had invited over his boss, Raymond Chow. They were all supposed to go out to dinner together. And Bruce was performing scenes, kung fu scenes, from his upcoming movie for the two of them. And he got really excited, and he was going through it. And then Raymond Chow told me in an interview, revealing a detail he'd never told before, that Bruce got faint and dizzy and a little thirsty. And then he complained of a headache. He went to lie down in Betty's bed, and he never got back up again.
Gosh, now your idea, where you conclude, you say it's just the most plausible scientific idea, is that he died of heat stroke. You also mentioned that some of his friends said that he could be vulnerable to heat. And so you start putting two and two together, and this is the idea that you think is the strongest, is that Bruce Lee just died of heat stroke. On May, he collapsed of... May 20th, he collapsed of heat stroke, and then July 20th, or May 10th, and July 20th, he died of heat stroke, you think?
That's right. It's been what's interesting about Bruce's story is that his death has always been intertwined with it, because he died in a way that no one could figure out. And so there were thousands of different conspiracy theories that he was killed, that the triads got him, that it was Hash. And so I spent nearly a year talking to experts and going through all the various theories and seeing what was plausible and what was not. And then it kind of struck me, there was one detail that no one had really mentioned, which was about 5 months before he dies, he had an operation to remove the sweat glands under his armpits. Yeah. And when I saw that detail, and the reason he did it was because he was sweating so much on screen and they always had to wipe him down and it was frustrating. And apparently this was a common operation back then. And when I saw that detail, I was like, that's it. That explains it. He was unable to dissipate heat as well as he would have been beforehand. It was a super hot day that summer. Hong Kong is a tropical environment. And that's probably what killed him.
It's interesting, all the rumors that come out. You referred to them. We should the chaos. And I mean, one of the rumors that came up was that his death was related to sex, that he had had too much sex, that in fact, one of the kind of strange details was that he had died with an erection. Like, this was an important point to all this rumor mongering going on.
Yeah. In fact, when I went back to Hong Kong, I would ask different people, how do you think he died? And I was told that by people who I should know better, that you can't actually die that way. Joe, if you could, it would be mankind's favorite way to commit suicide. There's just no way to die from too much sex. And so you would, all these crazy things happened. And the reason why is when he died in the apartment, Betty Ting Pei called Raymond Chow, who had gone to the restaurant without them. Right. And he came back and he realized what would occur if the news media found out that he had died in an apartment of a young, beautiful woman who wasn't his wife. And so Raymond Chow figured out a way to get him to a hospital for him to be declared dead at that hospital, and then told the press that he had collapsed at home with his wife. And so the cover up was to cover up the affair, not why he died. And that's where all the conspiracy came from, because as we know, when someone lies about something important, then people get really suspicious and, you know, the conspiracy theories bloom. Yep. And that's what happened with Bruce. Yeah.
It's never the crime. It's always the cover up.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, and he dies. He becomes a legend. You point out that before Lee's death, there were fewer than 500 martial arts schools in the entire world. But after Lee dies, by the 1990s, you point out, there were more than 21 million martial arts students just in the United States. Of course, you become one of them. How is it that his legend just takes off?
I think it captured, like everything in life, it's the person meets the moment. One aspect is that Bruce Lee in Enter the Dragon is completely magnetic. Yeah. He's an absolute star. And he's showing the West something it had never seen before. And it's so powerful that even I think I watched the movie in 1984, 85, you know, 12 years after the movie was released, and it seems like something new and fresh, and got me excited in the martial arts. Yeah. So there was that. And then I also think it's important to remember that the movie was released right at the end of the Vietnam War. Yeah. And the public had turned against the war, and people were looking for different solutions to problems. And there was something about seeing a powerful Asian man that I think was quite attractive. Mm.
You say he also changed how heroes fought. There used to be this idea that the hero would just throw a punch, the John Wayne punch, and that would be over. But Bruce Lee, you say, changed our idea of how a hero was supposed to fight.
That's right. I think that's one of the most complete and total victories he had on Western culture. I mean, he convinced 20 million Americans to study martial arts. So in that sense, that's his most important impact. But if you watch the movies, everybody's a martial arts master. All the comic book heroes, Batman, Sherlock Holmes, everyone can kick, they can punch, they knee, they elbow. But if you go back and look at the way people fought before 1973 on screen, It was what they call the John Wayne punch. You start off in left field, you swing around, you have a little conversation, the punch is still coming, and then it misses by a mile, and they clap a board, and the guy throws his head back, and that's considered action choreography. Yeah. So action choreography is completely transformed by Bruce Lee until today, where every major star fights like Keanu Reeves or Tom Cruise. Mm-hmm. They're all martial arts masters.
Matthew, I want to ask you this finally, because what I liked about the legacy of Bruce Lee was, as you mentioned in the book, he helped change Asians' self-perception. You say that his films brought about the rise of a more muscular and confident Hong Kong and Taiwan and even eventually China, and that seems to be a really powerful legacy.
I think it's very hard for us in the West to understand the level of humiliation and defeat that the Chinese felt for so long. They just felt like a people who would once were proud and had been beaten down by circumstances. And Bruce Lee, when he fights Chuck Norris in Way of the Dragon, gives them an image of a Chinese man able to beat a powerful white guy using kung fu, their own traditional culture, in order to achieve a victory. And many of the people in Hong Kong would say to reporters when asked, the reason why this meant so much to us is because we were beginning to compete in business, in banking, in manufacturing, but we felt inferior. And he gave us a sense we didn't have to be. And so when we think about the rise of China as a great power, as another superpower, it's important to understand that A, that sense of humiliation, and B, that desire to prove that they are the equal to the West.
That's Matthew Pauly. He's a fellow at Yale University. His new book is Bruce Lee, A Life. He joined us from a studio in New Haven, Connecticut. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.